Back at it for you on Monday, April 27th, right here on Connecticut Today, as we continue to follow the ever-changing coronavirus situation. How is COVID-19 affecting funerals and final arrangements in the state? We talk with the head of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association. The ever-expanding role of China and disinformation perhaps coming out of Beijing. We talked with a cyber expert upon that, and we also gave you a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's daily COVID-19 update. Alexander J. Scott is president of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association. Alex, I can only guess at how your industry has had to deal with immense changes here and precautions, from medical and biological precautions all the way to how you actually do your job vis-a-vis dealing with families and their grief.
It, very well said, Paul. And, you know, on a good day, this is a very difficult situation for anyone that's faced with a loss to have to deal with. Now that you've thrown in the topic of pandemic into this, and it's completely turned a lot of the way we do things upside down and in reverse, and called upon us to be very creative, and all parties involved to really have that kind of patience and an understanding. That what's frustrating is that this has been such a fluid situation that has evolved throughout just the past month. What was going on 2 weeks ago and what was going on 2 weeks prior to that are two completely different stories.
I can assume that you folks, when you learn what you do, Alex, your study of mortuary science, you know, there obviously are biological aspects to that. But what kind of training do you folks receive in the way of dealing with a body that may have succumbed from an infectious disease? I would imagine there's a base of training there that you have to build on with something like this.
Absolutely. And we've really found the safest and the most intelligent way to approach a situation is by using the concept of what is called universal precautions, where basically every deceased client you're coming into contact with, you are going to treat as though as if they had some form of a contagion present within their system. With that, we have a whole slew of different equipment and procedures and things that protocols that are exercised in the execution of any of the preparation process of the deceased, the types of equipment that the technicians will wear when they are performing such procedures. And so if you take a look at it across the board, is that everyone is going to be affected by this. You're not playing a guessing game of, well, does this person have something that could hurt me or my family or not?
Are you hearing, Alexander, concerns from some of your clients, or maybe are your co-directors hearing maybe concerns that, well, what are you going to do with my mom or my dad's body or my grandmother or grandfather? Don't do anything crazy because of COVID-19. Are there any concerns being voiced like that?
You know, I really have to give the media a massive thumbs up, because a lot of the families that are coming in to sit with us already know that things are going to be very different when they come in to sit down to talk with us. We've tried to also exercise social distancing, where we can really do as much as we can via telephone, via the internet, via Skype, any of those types of scenarios for them. And they understand the severity of the situation.
And we continue with Alexander J. Scott. He is president of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association, as we talk about how that business has been affected by COVID-19, how the men and women who make up the funeral directors and run the funeral homes all around the state and around America have been affected. Alex, is it tough? Have you had the need, perhaps, to work with people and tell them that they may not be able to have as large of a gathering as they want to? As you and I well know, there are very small, intimate wakes and viewings before a funeral, and then there are, you know, others where people are lined up out the door for 2 hours, depending upon who that person is. Have you had to alter those situations at all?
Painfully, yes, we have. There's no word a funeral director hates more in its vocabulary than having to say the word no to a family. Mm-hmm. And now more than ever, this whole situation has really called upon us to really be a trusted advisor and a guide to this family and not an order taker. We're not doing anyone any favors by saying, sure, you know, we can let this slide by. We can have as many people as you want. We'll just kind of keep things on the QT. It's just not going to work. And as far as my estimation is concerned, that the social distancing is really the number one combatant against the spread of this awful virus.
And, you know, Alex, they're hardly, I mean, I cannot remember, even on a smaller basis when there weren't that many family members there, you know, Alex, I cannot remember having a funeral home, a viewing for a loved one, or going to see someone who's had a dear one that has passed, whether it's a family member or friend, and not having been, you know, sitting almost touching each other and shoulder to shoulder and the
hugging,
physical greeting and the hugging,
right?
and being a pallbearer. I mean, these situations must not be easy for you sometimes.
They're very difficult, and it's kind of really changed the process and the way we have to handle things for folks. And the best way I've really kind of described it to people is that at this time, due to the situation as it is, our focus needs to be on getting the deceased to where they need to be. Mm-hmm. And as time evolves and things become more safe and the threat is not there and bans get lifted and we're still keeping in compliance with advice from the governor's office, the Department of Public Health, the CDC, that we can, as we maintain that relationship with that family as this time is going by, we can be creative with them and work out how we can perhaps have some type of a tribute that can take form on so many different levels, which is really where our creativity and gets to be a part of the situation here as far as having a memorial visitation where we can have create a slideshow of family photographs for folks, set up pictures and albums, and give people a venue where they can come and not only express their own grief towards the loss of this individual, but comfort those people who were really severely impacted by it.
And you're dealing, Alex, with people all the way, the range from, you know, secular humanists / atheists who believe in nothing to the most devout Christians, Catholics, Jews, Muslims. I mean, it's a real gamut, isn't it?
It is a melting pot of different religions and walks of life and ethnicities and customs that under different circumstances would be observed in a completely different manner. And to have to kind of say to folks, okay, this is what we're faced with right now. Here's what our choices are, because we really avoid the cookie cutter situation here. That everyone is different, no, just as unique as your own thumbprint is. And we don't want to put anyone in a category. So it really calls upon the funeral director to listen cognitively to these folks and determine what their very specific needs are and what's of the most utmost importance to one family could be the of least importance to the next.
Is it still possible, Alex, to have open casket viewings in this time or not?
Different firms, as long as the embalming procedure has been performed. Our firm, I'm employed with the Duxa family of Newington Memorial and Burritt Hill Funeral Homes, and we allow 5 people in the building at a time. And so we really kind of hedged that to saying that we're really going to keep this private and you can really invite who you'd like to have be there, just so the family's not overwhelmed with a massive crowd. And we don't want to be putting anyone in harm's way. Again, the social distancing is the real key factor in all of this. And so we'll allow folks to come in and still, even whether they're a known COVID case or not, we'll still allow them to have a distant viewing with that person and have some quiet time with them. And then, you know, depending on if there's a burial or a cremation following different facilities and places that we will have those types of services take place that have their own set of constrictions as well, too. I've had some cemeteries that will allow 20 people to be present, but only 10 up at the grave. So we have other people stay in the car, and we'll either FaceTime with them on our cell phones. We have a Bose system with a microphone, and so that way they can put their windows down and hear and be a part of the service close by. It's called upon us to get very creative in how we're going to accommodate everyone's unique needs with this, because the social distancing comes an emotional distancing, and that's the one thing that is really what helps people get through a lot of this. As humans, we're such gregarious people, and we need to be around others and, like you said, experience the human experience, the touch, the hug, a warm embrace, just kind words. Understanding that people understand what you are going through at this time, and to not to be able to have that immediately from the community as a whole in a traditional organic situation without a pandemic being present is a really big pill to swallow for a lot of these folks, I think.
And a few more minutes with Alexander J. Scott, president of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association. Alexander, before I get to my last couple of questions on what we're talking about today, I want to do this so I don't forget. The association is offering scholarships, correct, for high school? Yeah, can we talk about that for a minute? Go ahead.
We sure can. We're offering a scholarship to students that want to pursue a career in funeral service.
And what are the requirements? How much is it? How can they apply?
They can apply through ctfda.org and submit their application there. And there, if they go to our website, there will be all the criterion of what is required as far as their GPA levels, where they are in high school, and an essay as well as to what they're calling in funeral services and what attracted them to the business and what they plan to bring to the table for that. And we have different scholarships in different amounts available to different students that can help them further their studies along. And we certainly know that along with college expenses come all kinds of other types of expenses as well, too, with living expenses and food and books and supplies and all of those types of things. So it's wonderful that we're able to do that and bring the next generation into our industry.
And for people who don't know, and I know a lot of people do, Alexander, but for people who don't know, your profession is taught at mortuary science colleges, correct?
Yes. Goodwin Technical Community College holds the program in Connecticut right now, which is headed by a board member of CFDA, Mr. Jesse Gomes, a wonderful man, very versed in funeral service and an excellent funeral director, in addition to being an educator as well, too. And he heads up that program at Goodwin. And so if students are interested, I highly suggest you reach out to Jesse, and he'd be happy to sit and talk with you about it.
Great. Alexander, what if somebody comes to you and says, listen, we have a loved one who passed away. We understand the limitations. And they said, Mr. Scott, is there any way that we could, in the middle of this COVID-19, until we get past this, is there any possibility, and we can pay for it if it's possible, can we preserve the body of my grandfather, or grandma, mom, or dad until we get 4 or 5 months down the line so I can have a large unified gathering? What are the possibilities of that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different external factors that go into making that type of a call, and I try to really avoid those situations. I have not been faced with it personally yet, but certainly have been prepared to do so if that is presented my way. And because, again, like I said, this is such a fluid situation that has just taken on so many different forms, and we don't know how long this is going to go. And I think it'd be very irresponsible of a funeral director, I think, to say, yes, in 5 months we can do X, Y, and Z for you, and this is exactly how it's going to go. there's just so many unknowns with it, and I just don't think that we'd be and in the long run, if things did not work in the favor in which we thought they were going to work, that we'd be doing that family any favors. And to really encourage kind of taking care of things for now. Like I said, getting the deceased to where they need to be, and then we can work on getting the living to where they need to be.
Yeah, because I would imagine, Alexander, yeah, anything is possible, but you're talking about, what, long-term refrigeration or using different chemicals. Yeah,
right.
And I mean, I'm sure you folks could do it, but if everybody started doing that, that's a problem.
Right, absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish it.
I know there's just lots of variables that go into that, too. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation, depending on the cause of someone's death and the nature of different things that go along. And our bodies go through all of these processes naturally when we pass away, even though we've been prepared. There's different scenarios that come along with that. And to make a crapshoot guess as to how that's going to turn out is doing no one any favors.
Finally, what would you tell a loved one listening to us right now, Alex, who may say, mom and dad, if they pass during this situation, or whomever in their family, a grandmother, grandfather, I'm so disheartened that I won't be able to give them the real big send-off that I always promised them. What would you say to that?
Well, you know, I would... It's time for us to redefine what big send-off is then, I think, really. Obviously things are going to be different now because of the situation that we're faced with. So then we could say, well, we can do the exact same thing, just a little bit differently. Their body may not be present. They could be already buried, or we could have their ashes present at that send-off. All of the different components of things that would happen in a traditional organic situation can happen just down the road when we're able to gather and have all of that not a limit on who can be here and how long they can be here and what's going to be going on.
Interesting. So, yeah, it's the flexibility, I guess, is key. Alexander, we did have a caller who wanted to know how he or she could contact you. Can they get to you through the CTFDA website? Can they do
that? Yes, they can. They can. If they go to ctfda.org, they can certainly get my contact information there, or they can reach out to CTFDA and 860-721-0234. And our wonderful office administrator, Noelle Frechette, would be happy to take a message and relay it to me.
Okay, 860-721-0234. 860-721-0234 to our caller who called in, and the website ctfda.org, ctfda.org. Alexander J. Scott, president of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association. I have a couple of friends of mine who are in this line of work as well. Alexander and you folks do wonderful work. And thank you, and hopefully we will speak in the future. Stay safe and good luck. Thank you.
Same to you, Paul. Thank you for having us today.
Well, the cyber war apparently continues between the U.S. and China. We have a return visit here from our next guest, who was with us a couple, 3 weeks ago when this whole thing started. And everybody kind of expected this, but it's now hiked up even more. And our next guest is the CEO of Fort Alice Solutions, the author of Manipulated, Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth, former chief information officer during the George W. Bush administration at the White House, Teresa Payton, back on the line with us. Teresa, how are you? Welcome back. And how are you holding up during this whole thing?
Oh, thanks for asking. It's so great to be back with you today and, you know, doing what everybody else is doing, you know, looking on the bright side of things and, you know, focus on the future and doing my part, washing my hands, social distancing, but also studying the manipulators and making sure that they're not taking advantage of everybody.
Okay, so you and I talked a few weeks back, and you were in the kind of the mode, you were kind of a let's see what happens mode here, especially with China, a little bit Russia, but especially with China here. And I would suspect that, Teresa, you're at least partly in we told you so mode here, because we're seeing stories now continually that China kind of feeling backed into a corner here. They're now reacting online.
They really are reacting. And for starters, they vehemently deny that they are conducting manipulation campaigns, all the while posting from their official state-run government accounts on Twitter, which is kind of interesting since they restrict the social media platform usage by its own citizens. And it's very interesting, but they're very focused right now on persuasion and information management and really saying the USA needs to prove that it didn't originate in the USA, not in China. They actually pointed the finger at Italy as well. In addition to, you know, basically saying to everybody, we gave the rest of the world time to prepare. We handled it the best. And by the way, we're open for business while your factories are closed. I mean, it's just fascinating. They're kind of doing an all of the above campaign on promoting China's strength and earnestness in the process.
You know, Teresa, also, this is kind of a head scratcher here, too. I don't know whether you saw this over the past few days, but Bill Gates, for some reason, has come out over the past couple, three days. And I know he and his wife's foundation, they've probably done some good things around the world. I don't doubt that. But even Bill Gates, I think it was this morning or yesterday or over the weekend, Teresa, came out and essentially told us to take it easy on China, you know, back off here. This isn't doing anybody any good. Does that kind of surprise you or not? What do you think his end game here is? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the fine line that many CEOs, of course, he's a Microsoft co-founder now and not the current CEO.
Yeah.
But a lot of American companies, especially big tech, guess where a lot of big tech has employees or parts of their supply chain?
Mm-hmm.
It's in China. And so they're walking a fine line of not wanting to anger or disenfranchise the companies that they work with in China or the government of China, because the buying population is so huge. There's also a huge talent base. People in China, they're very well educated, very talented, very smart, and very good people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this challenge where we don't agree with the government practices. But at the same time, Bill Gates and other executives like him, they're trying to walk that fine line because, candidly, they need the talent base in China, and their supply chains are very much entwined, and it's hard to exclude China at this point.
And the last thing they want to do, Teresa, is to say, well, you know, my smartphones, my electronics, even the CD-ROM copies of my software that I still sell, I have to make them here now in the U.S., which is going to drive up my production costs and drive up the retail price I have to charge people.
I think what many of us who have looked at the risks and the threats to the supply chain have said for years is that we need to build in redundancy into our supply chain, and there should be a list of items that we all agree should be made here in the United States. So, for example, I think we saw it play out in a very negative way that if there were things that we didn't make here in the United States, pharmaceuticals, masks for people who work on the front lines of the healthcare profession,
mm-hmm.
respirators, if they weren't made here and we were depending upon an international supply chain to ship us the goods, guess what? Those planes weren't allowed to leave. Those ships weren't allowed to leave.
Yeah.
And so we found ourselves in a situation of having to ask American companies to quickly pivot and to actually manufacture things that we had outsourced to other countries, China not the only one. And then those countries said, sorry, I need this for myself. So this is a time for us to look and say, it is wonderful to have great trading partners. It is wonderful to, you know, kind of come up with different ways to have cost arbitrage. But at the same time, we need redundancy, security, reliability in our supply chain. And, oh, by the way, we need a new playbook and rule book that our trading partners need to play by. And we saw some of the worst of that come to the forefront when COVID-19 started hitting the globe. And we need to take some lessons learned out of this going into the next potential global crisis.
Few more minutes with a return guest, Teresa Payton. She runs Fort Alice Solutions, a cybersecurity consultancy. Try saying that with dry lips. She also has a new book out, Manipulated, Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth. She also served for a time as the White House Chief Information Officer under President George W. Bush. Teresa, explain to my listeners here what a bot farm is. What do the little bots look like when they grow up? But how those little baby bots may get to be big bots and affect what they see on their news and social media feeds?
Sure. I'm so glad you asked. So what a bot farm is and how it's used by manipulators is they actually create these little programs that mimic behavior of humans on social media. And so these little programs pretend to be, you know, a mom, a dad, a grandparent, a Gen Z, a Gen Y, a boomer. They may pretend to be somebody in Iowa or Florida. And then the bots basically through these programs will promote true news stories. They'll find trending hashtags and they'll start to engage real Americans in arguing different sides of an issue. These bots are managed by what's called a bot herder. And in the case of, for example, the 2016 elections, Russian state-trained operatives were managing lots of different bot farms as bot herders and arguing both sides of an issue. It might have been Blue Lives Matter versus Black Lives Matter. It could be to vaccinate your kids or not vaccinate your kids. And really, all it takes is just getting a few real Americans to engage, and then the bots move on to something else.
And that's just, I mean, that's wild. That's like, you know, and I think I've used this simile before. It's like throwing a bucket of chum or bait into the water. You're on the boat there and you're just sitting back and, you know, lighting up a cigarette and having a sandwich and watching all these sharks and fish go crazy because all you did was dump some chum in the water. And there you go. I got them going.
Yeah, and here's the craziest part. Not only do we end up arguing with each other, perhaps going out in the street and protesting, perhaps being disenfranchised and not voting, thinking your vote doesn't matter. But the other thing is they actually make a lot of money. So the more we end up clicking on their links and their attachments and taking the bait, we're paying them pennies on the click, and they actually make money while we're arguing with our fellow Americans.
So, Teresa, what should somebody do? I mean, say they're, and a lot of my listeners are like this, you know, they're on both sides of the issues and they want to stay engaged on social media. They enjoy the give and take, the back and forth. They're not vitriolic about it. A lot of people that argue with stuff, they're friends, they know each other. I mean, what should they watch out for? Are there any clues as to whether or not they're being trolled by Russia or North Korea or China in this whole thing? What would you tell them?
No, I love what you just said there, because I was raised in a family where we were encouraged to politically debate all the different issues and to make up our own mind and have our own opinions. And we love to sit around the dinner table and agree and disagree with each other. And Americans should do that. That's what makes America amazing. And it's why we're always improving and getting better. So here's a couple of telltale signs. If you see a headline and it says something like, never been reported before, never seen before, and there's a picture and it sounds really crazy, that's typically clickbait, and somebody's going to make money off of you clicking on that. So have a few trusted, vetted news sources that you like to go to. I always say pick one that's local to you, pick one that's national, and pick one that's international. So when you see something that sounds just absolutely incredible, either negative or positive, go to those other two.
Oh, did we lose her? Teresa? No.
If you find, are you there?
I'm here. Now I got you. Go ahead. I'm sorry. So I want to pick it up again before I dropped out a moment. Yeah. You were talking about, Teresa, if you could start over again on how people should pick a few of their favorite sites.
Sure. So pick one local to you. one that's a national news site, and one that's international. So if you see something trending, go check those three sources. If you feel like you and your friends and your loved ones are being played by manipulators, one of the best things you can do is actually report it on the social media platform that you saw it posted. Mm-hmm. That will actually help those social media platforms train their algorithms to spot these different manipulation campaigns. But that can be a great way. If you have those different sources, that can be a great way. It takes, you know, longer to explain than it does to actually check across those three to see if something really is accurate or if you're being played.
Sure. Great stuff. As always, Teresa Payton, former White House Chief Information Officer. She's also the founder and CEO of Fort Atlas Solutions, name of her latest book, Manipulated, Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth. Teresa, thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you again in the future. Stay safe, be well, and good luck, and we will talk to you down the line. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Thanks for having me on. Please
thanks,
have me back.
Thanks, Teresa. Thanks.
And I got to say, food seemed to be question number one, two, and three. It's food insecurity, be they farms, be they restaurants, or just folks trying to get a meal. And as you remember, Susan Biasowitz and I were at Rentschler Field just last week, and I remember these were all folks lined up for 2 hours ready to get some food from folks there. And these are all folks who had a really good job just 6 weeks ago. So it's incredibly important. Just to give a little overview of what else we're going to be doing this week. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little more about contact tracing and testing, just because that is all part of our reopening strategy. And so important to being able to isolate anybody who has been infected and who they were in contact with. Later in the week, then we're going to have our Reopen Connecticut team, Indra and the good doctor, and there we're going to start laying out a strategy between now and May 20th and then after May 20th and what we can open on a very methodical basis. And then finally on Friday, we've got our end of the month numbers that show you where we are for the end of this fiscal year, which ends June 30, and then the next fiscal year. And to be blunt, while the numbers are not very pretty, we look pretty good compared to a lot of our peers. So we'll go into that in some detail with Melissa McCaw. Just a couple of things that came to mind as I keep looking over at Asia to see what the heck's going on, what we can expect. It's sort of the tale of two cities over there. You've got places like Hong Kong and Singapore where they have a small resurgence going on again. And we wanted to make sure that does not happen here in Connecticut. But one of the reasons is Hong Kong has a lot of flights going in and out. Singapore has migrant labor in and out. So it just reminds you over in this part of the world, to the degree to which we can slow up a lot of travel, it'll make a difference for the long term. And the good news is over in New Zealand and Australia, where if you saw, they are slowly, through strict social distancing, bringing the infection rate to zero. So there is a light at the end of the tunnel if we focus on what we've got to do and what we've got to do appropriately. Supply chain, I just got off the phone with all our fellow governors and the White House task force. As I applied, it's sort of interesting what's going on in different parts of the country. Talking about supply chain, remember back in the 70s when we realized we were terribly dependent upon oil, mainly Middle East oil and OPEC, and what that meant in terms of those long lines at the gas station. And we've worked on our energy independence now 40 years later. We're much better off than we were before. But it was just interesting hearing from some states like North Dakota and Wyoming, for example, where they have very low COVID infection-related rates, but they get half their budget from taxes on gas, taxes on natural gas and coal. And there, they've seen their revenues disappear by 30-40%. So it's worth remembering how this pandemic affects different states in different ways. Speaking of, again, the supply chain, I think we have learned as a country how important control over our own destiny was, just like OPEC reminded us how important it was for energy independence back during the 1970s. I mean, we've obviously found out the hard way when it comes to protective gear, when it comes to gowns, when it comes to masks. Josh and I spent a lot of time, waiting for the plane to land from China. And we realize that going forward, this is something in our supply chain we want to get more control over. Antibiotics are the same way. I mean, most of the antibiotics come from overseas, generally ingredients that come from China, often processed the antibiotics in India. And India put a hold on, exporting antibiotics for a while because they had their own pandemic. Again, when you think of PPE, you think of antibiotics, these are things in our supply chain that we'd like to get control over ourselves. And that brings us to food. And you probably remember from the last couple weeks the tragedy of all those cars lined up at Rentschler Field, desperate to get just a few days' worth of groceries. At the same time, you saw farmers around the country, getting rid of milk, and what's going on in our poultry and our chicken and our meat processing plants. Tyson Foods just did an ad today. You maybe saw it in some of the big newspapers saying, watch out, we could have some interruptions in our food supply. So with that in mind, over the last week or so, we've been meeting with them, talking with Brian and Deirdre about how we can get control over our own food supply. And I know we don't make most of what we eat here in the state, but let's do a better job of aggregating what we can and keep that food supply going so we don't have any farmers or dairy pouring milk away while people are lined up. And that's what Brian Herbert's going to be doing for us. As you know, Brian, he's our commissioner of agriculture, does an extraordinary job there, very close with the farmers. And so it's in that capacity that I thought he was the ideal person to help lead our effort when it comes to consolidating our food supply chain from the farmers, be it dairy and then produce over time, right down to food share and food bank and the people who are getting that distributed. And then Deirdre will talk a little bit more on the other side of the equation, because we have SNAP, which is the food support program we get from the federal government, in ways perhaps we can use the restaurants as part of our distribution system to get prepared meals to seniors who really won't be able to leave their homes for a while, at least not be able to do it as safely as we'd want. So, Brian, what are your thoughts about how we can shore up our food supply chain here in the state of Connecticut and what that means for folks who are looking forward to being counted on a meal?
Thank you, Governor, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in this. It's not necessarily the normal role of the Commissioner of Agriculture, but it's one that I welcome. For those of you who are familiar with me and my background, I did work at Wholesome Wave as a senior VP for a while, and working on food insecurity and access to food issues. So Deirdre and I have been talking about this, about how we can do this. We've really put it into four separate buckets about where we can support the access to food. The first is food insecurity. First, I'd like to acknowledge and thank the employees and the volunteers that have led the food share and Connecticut Food Bank distribution efforts. I also was at the regional market a couple weeks ago with the Lieutenant Governor and seeing firsthand how many families were in need, but also how many families have stepped up to volunteer their time for food distribution. So we've been able to increase SNAP allotments, SNAP eligibility, and the duration that families can stay on SNAP. Also, on the food system side, how can we make sure that our agricultural and food service industries are providing for those in need? And so we can tie those efforts into the recovery seamlessly and make sure that that families have the access that they need, that we're giving outlets for farmers and for restaurants to continue to contribute to our economy. We're doing that through increasing access to aggregation. We're doing that through increasing SNAP access at farmers markets and farm stands. Finally, food distribution. We also need to acknowledge that it's not only people who are food insecure that are going to have challenges accessing food during all of this, but it's also folks that are quarantined or self-isolating. And so that becomes very important, that we have ways to get food to them. And then also food availability. How can we make sure that we work with our grocery partners, that everybody continues to have access to food? So those are the four buckets that we are looking to align together with a lot of the current efforts that have been going on to make sure that we're doing this in complete conjunction and collaboration across agencies, partner organizations, and outside groups. And Deirdre is going to speak a little bit about some of the efforts that have already happened that will make food more available for families in need in Connecticut.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor, and thank you, Commissioner Hurlburt. Happy to have the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon about some of the things that we're doing at the Department of Social Services to address the food issues that the governor and the commissioner have talked about. I want to start by acknowledging that we understand that this is a difficult time for many families because of the impacts of the pandemic, and that food insecurity is a problem, and in some cases, a problem for the first time for many families. And so we wanted to share with you some of the things that the Department of Social Services has been able to do, and then answer your questions. As the governor mentioned, we're privileged to be able to operate the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP program for families at DSS. Prior to the pandemic, we were serving about 350,000 individuals on that program. And we've done a number of things to make it easier to get and keep SNAP, and also to get more benefits to the people that are receiving SNAP already, and expand. So we were very excited that on Friday the governor was able to announce that Connecticut has been approved for our so-called pandemic EBT program, PEBT. That's a program that was authorized by Congress and signed into law that will provide a new benefit to the families of 270,000 Connecticut children who live in towns that serve a large number of free and reduced price lunches. So families will not need to apply for this new benefit. We are working to get those cards generated and mailed out to families, and we thank the Connecticut Department of Education for their partnership in this program, and that will get about $72 million in SNAP benefits to these families. In addition to that, we've been able to receive waivers to make sure that everybody who is receiving SNAP already is getting the maximum amount. So we've announced in the past that in April, we were able to put $30 million additional dollars onto families' SNAP cards. And I'm happy to say that we've also received approval to add another increased allotment in the month of May. So another $15 million will go onto the EBT cards for families in the month of May. We've also extended SNAP eligibility. So if you were a recipient that was due to renew your benefit in April, May, or June, you won't have to worry about doing that. Your benefits have been automatically extended for 6 months well into the fall. We've reduced the number of people who need to have an interview in order to receive their SNAP benefit. So that's making it much quicker for a lot of people to apply, and we're happy to be able to do that. And we've also been able to eliminate some of the work requirements that were previously part of the SNAP program to make it easier for people to keep their benefit. And finally, something that DSS has received a lot of questions about, just to let you know that we are planning for online access to food with SNAP benefits. That has been something that wasn't previously available to Connecticut families, but we're working with our partners at the USDA to be able to allow families with an EBT card to purchase food online and have it delivered or picked up. So look for more details on that later in May. And finally, I just wanted to mention that, as Commissioner Hurlburt mentioned, we are talking about working with FEMA for somewhat longer-term plans to be able to supply food to people who need to be at home during this pandemic, whether that's because they're elderly and at higher risk for infection, or because they're isolated or quarantined because they themselves are ill or have been exposed. And one of the things that we've been talking about is how can we get food delivered to those people. We're working on plans in conjunction with our partners at FEMA on how we can potentially engage our restaurant industry in getting meals prepared and delivered. We're not able to purchase prepared food with SNAP benefits, so this will be a new process that we're working on that we hope will both assist our restaurant industry and address some of the food needs of people who are at home.
Hey, well, thank you, Deirdre and Brian. I mean, it's amazing what you're doing, not only feeding folks who are hungry and suddenly realized how insecure they were, but also doing what you can to help our farmers and doing what you can to help our restaurants. And before we take questions, let me just give you a quick update on where we are over the last few days, and in particular today. The COVID summary, I think of particular interest is the hospitalizations is down, and it's down again. And that's net hospitalizations, meaning there are more people being discharged than are being admitted. Sadly, the fatality rate is still high. The next chart is sort of reflects where you are again. Again, you'll see that Fairfield is down. You'll see that New Haven is flat, and you'll see that Hartford is flat. So that's where you're finding lower hospitalization rate, more capacity, which gives us a lot more room. And I always care about admissions because a lot of these hospitalization numbers sort of reflect not just how many people are going in, but how many are going out. And yet new hospitalization sort of reflects perhaps more what's going on out there. And while there were 162 new admissions to our hospitals yesterday, that's down quite a bit, about 25% over the last day. Those numbers are lumpy, Josh reminds me, but hopefully there's a trend going on there. That next chart is really key because this just gives you an idea of what the three-day moving average is. And this is really important because, as you know, the White House Task Force has said 14 days of declining hospitalization is an indicator that you're able to move into a space where perhaps you can start thinking about opening some things up on a limited basis. 28 days gives you a lot more flexibility. I think their recommendations, their guidance is pretty good. So you'll see based on this, it's not a straight line, but we're about 7 days into this downslope. And that means another 7 to 10 days, I think we can start making some announcements about places that we can go and places that can be opened. With that, Max, I'm happy to take any questions. And again, Brian and Deirdre are here as well as Paul and Josh.
We'll start with the Connecticut Mirror.
Yes, Governor, today Dr. Kumar at Hartford Healthcare talked about preparing people for a long haul regarding social distancing. So can you put into context what people should expect over the summer and fall as you ease these restrictions if these numbers indeed hold up?
Well, this is why I have a task force of business and scientific folks who are looking at this every day. You know, my estimation is we're going to open up those things which you can do safely, those things where you can social distance. You know, maybe that's going to be, you know, the rest. We didn't close most of our retail. We didn't close much of it at all, except for the fact that a lot of it we made for pickups. So maybe we'll find over time those pickup places you can go in as long as you have a mask and the appropriate social distancing. As you know, when it came to manufacturing, it came to big outdoor construction, we never changed that. As you move on into the summer, obviously, with warmer weather, maybe you'll find that restaurants, outdoor eating is something that we can find we can do relatively safely, but perhaps an indoor crowded bar is something we can't figure out how to do safely in the near term. And one of the things the task force is doing, Paz, is they were asking all the folks in industry, what are their best ideas in terms of how they can provide services safely? That gives you an idea, I think, of how you start, you know, moving into the summer and we slowly get back to a new normal.